Bella, whatever. I sit back on my heels, absorbing the shock. Oh. Still digging, still focused earthward, she says, "Your writing's come a long way." I know, in my heart of hearts, she means this as a compliment. It still feels couched in an insult. "Thanks," I say. "You've always been talented," she goes on, the pressure easing from me, only to push down again when she adds, "You could be doing anything." I don't want to fight with her. That's the last thing Dad would want. But I suddenly feel too thorny and raw to accept any subtle digs about my career without snapping. It's not just about me, I remind myself. My mom's got her own stuff she's dealing with. I take the hat back off and hand it to her, determined to maintain a breezy smile. "I'm going to see if the shower's free yet," I say. She nods once without meeting my eyes. I stand and go inside. After lunch, we pack the car and say our goodbyes. "Feel free to come back anytime," Mom says to both of us, and I know she means it. In lieu of hugs, she gives us a stack of leftovers in Tupperware and walks us partway to the car, lingering at the point where the walkway spills into driveway. "Safe travels," she calls from there, like she can't come any farther, and waves over her head. "Thanks," we call back in unison as we climb inside. "Love you," I add through the rolled down window. "You too," she says, and then we're pulling away. It's strange how no place on earth feels like home to me, like this house shrinking in the distance. And yet every time I'm there, I can't help but feel it's too tight around me, like a sweater that shrunk, or the house in Alice in Wonderland that Alice ends up wearing like a dress after she eats the magic cake.
"You okay?"
Hayden asks from the passenger seat as we reach the intersection of the driveway and the road. For once, I'm not in the mood to talk. "I'm good," I say, pulling onto the road. He nods, but after a few seconds clears his throat and says,
"You can talk about it, Alice."
"I'm good," I repeat. In my peripheral, he shakes his head.
"You're not good. You're upset."
"What am I upset about?" I say. He gives a frustrated laugh, but doesn't answer right away. "What?" I press.
"Your mom," he says. "You're angry with her."
My face warms. "Why are you acting like you're mad at me now?"
"I'm not trying to. I just don't understand why you won't say something."
"About what?" I ask, my own irritation mounting to match his.
"About how she just made you feel."
He throws his hands up like it should be obvious.
"About how she doesn't ask you about your job or your life, and when it comes up, she can't wait to move on. About how it hurts you that she doesn't read your stuff, and how when you reach for her, she literally pulls away. And instead of telling her you're angry with her, you're just bottling it up and pretending it's fine, even with me, even when I can see it's not fine."
"Stop," I murmur.
"I just don't understand why you won't admit you're..."
"Stop," I say, louder than I mean to, but not steady, shaky, trembling, overwhelmed. "I'm sorry you think it's some moral failing that I choose to focus on the good things in life, but not everyone sees things like you. Not everyone wants to just go through life like a steamroller."
"This isn't about me,"
he says quietly.
"It is about you."
My grip tightens on the steering wheel. My eyes burn.
"I'm sorry you felt like you had to be the perfect, happy little mayor's son who had to hide all of his feelings."
"That's not what this is,"
he snaps back.
"But that's not me," I go on. "I'm okay with my life. I'm happy with it. I don't know why you need me to be angry with her, but..."
"Because you're lying to yourself,"
he says.
"You're pretending the whole world is rainbows and butterflies, like I can't see what's right in front of my face. You're a journalist. You're smarter than that."
Now the anger surges through me. Not at my mother, at him, and at myself for bringing him here with me, for putting myself in this situation to be seen in a way I've never wanted to be, by someone who, by nature, doesn't leave well enough alone.
"You're right," I cry. "I am smarter than this. I should have known better than to take a man I barely know to my home. But I guess it's like you said, I was just lying to myself, pretending you were someone else."
The car falls silent. I'm shaking, my breath shallow and hot from my forehead to my toes.
I try to talk the anger back into its tunnel deep inside me. I keep myself from looking over at him, from imagining the hurt or frustration that might be on his face. I'm fine. Everything's fine. I just need to get back to Little Crescent to finish this audition, to get this job and write this book, and everything will be okay, like it always is. I turn on the radio, and Diamond Rio's Meet Me in the Middle plays, the irony nearly as thick as the tension. We don't say another word for the rest of the drive. By the time we pull up to the Grand Lucia, night has begun to descend, and the ice between us is no closer to thawing. I half expect Hayden to invite me in for a minute, but one glance at his steely face tells me that's not going to happen. It's probably for the best. For once, I don't really have the energy to socialize. I need to be alone, to refocus on the job, to figure out how to handle these last 2 weeks of interviews. He averts his gaze as he unlocks the passenger door and gets out. He pulls his bag from the back seat, pausing for a beat.
Goodbye, Alice.
He swings the door shut and heads for the stairs without a glance back. It's only once he's out of sight that I realize he said goodbye, not goodnight.
You don't seem quite like your usual overly chipper self today, Margaret says.
We're sitting across from each other at the table in her workshop on Tuesday morning, each of us polishing off our own latte from Little Croissant while she arranges shards of sea glass into a rough pattern in front of her. I'll be okay, I say with a reassuring smile. Her forehead lifts skeptically.
This process not going how you hoped?
It's not that, I say quickly. It's just family stuff. She sets down the two pieces of green glass she was arranging.
You can talk about it if you'd like.
I laugh a little. No, that's okay. We should get back to you.
He's the same way, you know, she says.
What? Who?
Hayden, she says. Hates talking about himself.
I stuff down a laugh. You're trying to make him talk about himself? Despite his and my fight, I'm still charmed picturing it, this feisty woman trying to trick her staid interviewer into dishing about himself. She gives a small shrug.
It only seems fair. I'm airing out all my dirty laundry.
At the not quite believing look I give her, she changes course.
Fine, a lot of my dirty laundry. The least he could do is let down his guard a bit. But that boy is basically an animated suit of armor, as far as I can tell.
I think he's just private, I say, surprised by my defensiveness. I think you can understand that.
Have the two of you spent much time together? She asks.
My eyes dart to the recorder, aware that everything I say will be captured. It's one thing to make myself vulnerable with her, but it's another to drag Hayden into it, even if he and I aren't on the best terms right now. I settle on, a little, yeah.
And what do you think? She says bluntly.
About? I ask.
Hayden, she says. Do you still think I can trust him? You think there's a warm, beating heart under all that ice?
The flicker of memories that licks across my mind is tawdry. I pray I'm not flushing. And even as the hurt and irritation of our last conversation push up through those other flashes, the truth is, I mean it when I say, you can trust him. At the return of her suspicious eyebrow tilt, I add, he's got his reasons for being guarded, but he's always honest. You can trust him. I trust him. There's no talking myself out of it. I just do. That's why what he said bothered me so much. Because if he's saying it, I can't shake the idea that there might be some truth to it. Margaret looks at me for a long moment, and then, quite suddenly, drops her eyes and hands back to the glass shards.
So, she says, where did we leave off last time?
The story. Their version. Margaret Ives loved the camera. Her version. The camera loved Margaret Ives, and she didn't mind one bit.
Laura was the great beauty of the two of them, but whereas the younger Ives sister was shy and bookish, Margaret was expressive, talkative, curious. Being raised in the Ives bubble had made Laura cautious and timid about the world, whereas Margaret was voracious for it. She wanted to try everything, go everywhere, meet everyone. Even as a very little girl, she'd strike up conversations with perfect strangers, smile and wave to anyone who looked their way, while Laura hid her face against their mother's trouser-clad leg. But then their parents split, and Bernie wasn't there for Laura to hide behind anymore. That was when Margaret discovered her superpower: getting attention. She loved the way it made her feel when she could make someone smile or laugh, like the whole world was opening up to her. But even negative attention was better than none, because so long as people were watching her, they'd leave her sister alone. When Laura wore drab neutrals, Margaret adorned herself in burning red. When Laura got a dreadful haircut after an incident with chewing gum, Margaret bought a ludicrous hat and refused to take it off for weeks. When Laura tripped in front of everyone at a gala in the blue ballroom, not to be confused with the green or gold ballrooms, Margaret knocked over an entire champagne tower, whooping with laughter as she slipped in the spill, then bowing to the resulting applause when she'd clambered back to her feet. When Laura gained weight and the society pages took notice, discussing her body like a stage play in need of a review, Margaret started a small fire in the bathroom at her all-girls school and got kicked out. Her stoic, intimidating grandfather hadn't looked at her for 2 weeks of family dinners after that, which made her feel like she needed to not just escape the House of Ives, but also potentially crawl out of her own skin. But still, it was worth it. She drew the eye everywhere she went, sometimes by accident, but often by design. People were going to talk about her family anyway. Why not be the one to make them laugh? It had worked for her favorite cousin, Ruth, and now she was an actress on a beloved sitcom and married to the love of her life. It more or less worked for Margaret, too, until she turned 16. In 1954, the night before Margaret's birthday, Ruth and her husband James planned to take their small plane down the California coast. There was going to be a celebration at the House of Ives, and Ruth wouldn't have dreamed of missing the chance to dote on Margaret, the little girl who'd once trailed her around the orange groves like an eager puppy. They'd always had a special friendship. Ruth made Margaret feel as though it was okay to be her in all her fantastic brightness. But on takeoff, the engine of James' plane experienced trouble. They crashed. James Oller was a decorated World War II veteran, and Ruth was a rising comedienne, irresistible in her television role as the gorgeous, accidentally hilarious ingenue next door. It seemed the whole country had mourned them together, aside from Ruth's own father, who'd grieved her death the same way he'd celebrated her birth, in private. Margaret had been devastated. It had changed her. It had changed her grandfather, too. Before that, Gerald was a domineering presence in the House of Ives, the kind of man you might not like, and yet still caught yourself jumping through hoops to please. After Ruth's death, he'd shrunk. It was like turning on a light in your bedroom and realizing the terrifying shadows in the corner had just been a jacket hung on a peg all along. Without her dear cousin's affection or her grandfather's harsh eye, Margaret felt as though a shackle connecting her to the House of Ives had been cut. Laura's reaction was different. The more Margaret pulled away from the family, the nearer her meek younger sister drew. She saw a wound in her grandfather that no one else did, or else no one was willing to admit they'd noticed. It made sense. Laura was always more comfortable being face-to-face with pain, more at ease with the bluer shades of life, whereas Margaret spent every second of every day trying to get back to the golden magic of her childhood when life was one endless possibility. Not long after Ruth's death, Gerald suffered a stroke that left him mostly blind. For months after leaving the hospital, he spent his days shut away in his rooms in the East Wing. Then Laura began to visit him, to read to him. And after a while, he left his rooms and started passing his days in the library. She'd bring his cigars there, cut and light one for him, arrange his ashtray so that he could easily find it on the windowsill, and then she'd take the overstuffed armchair opposite him and read for hours, stopping only to light a new cigar whenever he asked. He had nurses at first, but over time, Laura took over his care entirely. She earned his trust, collected his secrets, while her sister, Margaret, was out on the town, being photographed at every boutique, restaurant, and nightclub of the time. Margaret never wanted to go back to her life of being wrapped in tissue paper on a shelf in the House of Ives. She wanted a big life. She dated movie stars and did some modeling. She traveled to France, Spain, Monaco. She danced with Rock Hudson and drank under the exotic birds of Ciro's with Frank Sinatra and Marilyn Monroe. Once, she broke a heel on her way out of Macambo, and paparazzi captured shots of her being carried to her car, head thrown back in laughter, by a doorman who'd later sold the broken heel for a pretty penny. She was not graceful, poised, demure, or reserved. She was silly, irreverent, and clumsy, and the press adored her for it. The tabloid princess, they called her. She attended her mother's movie premieres, often with one of the film's leads, and was once photographed on the back of James Dean's motorcycle, clutching a wedding veil to her head and laughing as they peeled away from the curb. They were only seen together one other time after that, the night after which she was spotted at dinner with another up-and-comer. This earned her a new nickname, Two-Date Peggy. The truth was, she hadn't been on even one date with James Dean. The wedding veil was a gag, a rap gift that Bernie had jokingly given him when they finished filming A Western Wind Blows. Margaret had been visiting her mother when she bumped into Jimmy and mentioned that she'd always wanted to ride a motorcycle. He'd volunteered to make her day, and she'd popped the veil onto her head, hiking her skirt up and swinging one leg over the motorcycle's seat behind him. She didn't worry about what the press would say. Her whole life outside of the House of Ives had been carefully observed, but at least it was hers. She was an expert at chit-chat, at having a bit of fun, and doing so fought back the loneliness of her life at home without any real risk. The more they wrote about her exploits, the less gravity any of it seemed to have to her. Laura was different. The more fascinated the paparazzi became with Margaret, the more salacious their gossip, the less Laura was willing to leave the house. She withered. She wandered, she read to her grandfather and recorded his own stories. She listened to the radio and argued with him about the merit of the newly popular rock and roll. She pushed his wheelchair on walks through the grounds and described the sunset to him, and while she insisted to Margaret that she was perfectly happy with her life, Margaret worried. She worried endlessly about her soft-hearted younger sister. Their grandfather's health was declining fast, and while she didn't know that she'd ever understand her sister's friendship with him, Margaret was terrified about what would happen to Laura once he was gone, when someday their parents were gone too. Margaret begged Laura to go out with her, to meet people their age, to attend dinners, to appear at fundraisers and visit art museums and take drives down to the beach, or join her on boats with the handsome men and beautiful starlets she befriended. But the inevitable attention terrified Laura. "I don't want to be photographed," she'd say. "I don't want to be seen." Margaret would sometimes go to visit her mother at work or walk past her father's mahogany office at home and catch the tail end of a murmured phone call between her parents. They'd take turns in the two distinct roles of worrier and consoler. They'd promise each other that their younger daughter would be all right. They'd agree not to push her. And then Cosmo Sinclair came to town. The boy wonder of rock and roll. At least that was the nickname he'd had 2 years earlier, before a different singer usurped him as king. Now, the tabloids, the same ones calling Margaret Two-Date Peggy, had dubbed him the poor man's Elvis. But neither of these titles were what interested Margaret. His music didn't really interest her either, from what she'd heard at that point. The only thing that interested her about Cosmo Sinclair was her younger sister's total adoration of him and the fact that he'd be performing at the Pan Pacific Auditorium soon. She had an idea. It ballooned into an obsession that snowballed into a plan. One night, she would sneak her sister out of the house for one perfect night. That was all it would take. to change their lives forever. 23. Where's Jody? I ask Margaret as she's walking me back through her house to the front door at the end of our session.
Taking some much-needed time off. She gives me a dry look. Apparently, I'm something of a pill.
Hard to swallow, but ultimately good for your health? I ask. She laughs, grabs my arm affectionately as we reach the door, and she pulls it open.
Now, you're prepared for the storm, aren't you?
The storm? I step out under yet another late-afternoon scorcher of a Georgia day, but note that while we were inside, the cirrus clouds that were hanging along the horizon have been replaced by great dark masses, the wind ripping through the front garden, making everything shiver.
News is tracking it, she says. Should get to us tomorrow, and it's not a hurricane yet, but you know how these things are.
June through November, I agree, scanning the sky one more time.
I guess you forgot what it's like when it rains out in Hollywood,
she teases me. I smile. I did, actually.
Well, you're welcome to come hunker down here if you want, she says. We've got a guy coming to cover the windows and everything tomorrow. You'd better make sure there's a plan at your place.
I'll check with the rental management company, I promise, and then she sends me on my way. I haven't heard from Hayden since we got back into town, and as I park at the grocery store and head inside, I debate texting him. The winds have already amped up further since I left Margaret's, the rain finally starting to hit. The grocery store is not only packed, but thoroughly picked over. I grab a jug of water, some candles and batteries, and the kinds of snacks that won't require a refrigerator or a microwave, just in case. When I get back to the house, someone from the rental company, a middle-aged man with a chest-length brown beard, is there, in an anorak, swinging his toolbox into the bed of his pickup.
"Tried to call you,"
he shouts over the pouring rain as I run with my grocery bags toward him.
"Sorry,"
I shout back.
"Got you all situated."
He jerks his chin toward the plywood he's fixed over the bungalow's windows.
"Thank you so much,"
I shout back.
"You should be good here," he says. "Not supposed to turn into a hurricane, just a big storm."
"Got it."
I nod, shivering in the cold as the rain pounds against my skin, plastering my clothes to me.
"I'll let you get inside,"
he says, and I thank him again as he gets in his trunk, then run the rest of the way to the front door and let myself in. The house is dark with all its windows blacked out, and for the first time since I got here, I'm cold. I peel off my shirt and throw on the first sweatshirt I come across, then run around the house flicking on lamps, stopping by the bathroom to wring my hair out over the tub. Afterward, I change into dry sweatpants and clean, dry socks and unload the groceries. I find the emergency lanterns in the linen closet and check the batteries, replacing the ones that are dead, and I arrange the pillar candles in the bathroom, living room, and kitchen, just in case, with lighters or matches by each of them. It's been years since I've been caught in a storm like this, and I'm trying to run through the checklist I used to know by heart as a kid. I double-check that the fire extinguisher is under the kitchen sink, and I find a first aid kit in the bathroom, then gather my passport and driver's license and put them by the door, all things that seemed overkill to me when I was a teenager, given how many storms we'd weathered without any real danger or damage. But that was back then, when I had parents to watch out for me and a house that was an hour from the coast. This is different. My stomach growls miserably, and I decide to make myself a veggie burger while I've still got electricity. After I've eaten, I debate taking a shower before deciding the thunder has already moved too close. I settle instead for the world's fastest face washing, then smooth some retinol and moisturizer over my cheeks and forehead before going back to the living room. I flop down on the couch and turn on the TV, then realize I must have left my phone in the other room when I changed. I pad back to the bedroom and grab it off the foot of the bed, only to find the screen dark and unresponsive. Shit. No wonder the maintenance guy couldn't get a hold of me. I yank my charger from the wall and take it back into the living room with me, plugging my phone in right beside the couch. On TV, The Real Housewives of Miami is playing, the volume nearly all the way down. The house rumbles as a pocket of thunder draws nearer, and the wind howls against the plywood-covered windows. My phone finally has enough power to turn on, and messages start buzzing in one after another, along with a couple of voicemails. When I see a text from Margaret, I tap it open immediately. At that precise second, there's a loud cheep sound from the kitchen, and the power goes out, plunging me into dark. I only manage to read, "You're still welcome to come here if you'd feel safe," before my phone shuts off. I'm abruptly reminded of what I missed from the storm prep checklist. Charge your devices while you still can. I fumble through the dark to the nearest lantern and click it on, bathing the room in pale light, then using it to make my way around the space, lighting the pillar candles. Without the low drone of the TV, the wind's shriek seems louder, more intimidating. I need to be judicious with my computer battery since my phone's dead, but I figure now might not be the worst time to double-check that the storm hasn't been upgraded to a hurricane. I dig my laptop out of the bag by the front door, then fling myself onto the couch, only to realize my mistake. Another mistake. Without electricity, there's no internet. "You're worrying for nothing," I tell myself. "It's just a storm. I've been through hundreds. I just need something to distract myself with." Work usually does the trick. I can read through my notes by candlelight, brainstorm a little bit. I pad back to grab my notebook from the bag, and right as I'm nearing the door, something slams into it from the outside, making me jump and yelp. Two more swift thumps follow the first, and then two more. Almost like, is someone knocking? I run over to it and push my eye against the peephole to find a tall, darkly dressed figure hunched against the sideways sheet of rain, his fist thwacking at the door. I swing it open, and the wind and precipitation gust inside, pushing Hayden forward.
"What are you doing?"
I yell over the onslaught. His eyes are wild, his drenched hair tucked behind his ears, and his clothes absolutely sopping.
"I'm sorry,"
he says. And in this context, I'm so confused that all I can do is shout back, "What?"
"I'm sorry,"
he yells. I shake my head and explain what I really meant when I said what.
"What the fuck were you thinking coming out in this?"
I grab his jacket as I step back into the house, pulling him with me. It takes both of us to get the door shut and latched, and then I round on him again.
"You could have been killed," I rage.
"You weren't answering your phone," he says. "Margaret couldn't get a hold of you either. What was I supposed to do?"
I stare at him for a second, his face torqued, rivulets racing down the sharp planes of his face, joining the absolute pool at our feet. A couple of weeks ago, I would have mistaken the furrow in his brow for cold irritation, but now it couldn't be more obvious to me. He was scared. He was worried for me. The same way that on Sunday night in the car he'd been worried for me, not just annoyed, not judging me for how I handle things with my mom, but worried. And I don't know what to say to any of it, so I just pitch myself at him. I fling my arms around him, pressing up onto my tiptoes, and within a second or two, his arms come around me too, and we just hold on to each other, the rainwater from his clothes and skin seeping through my second change of clothes of the day. I don't care. He's shivering in my arms, his left hand wrapped around his right wrist at the small of my back.
"I'm sorry,"
he murmurs again against my temple. "Me too." I shake my head as I tear myself away from him. The flicker of the nearest candles catches the edge of his jaw, but otherwise his face is caught in the dark. "You were right."
"No, you were," he says. "There's stuff I should explain."
"Let me find you dry clothes first," I say, pulling him deeper into the house. He waits in the living room while I duck into the bedroom with the lantern. I find my biggest t-shirt and pair of sweatpants, along with a pair of socks I think Theo must have left at my apartment ages ago because they're definitely not a women's size 9. They are, however, the most comfortable socks I've ever worn. "There are towels in the bathroom," I tell him when I emerge. I tuck the stack of clothes into his elbow and hand him the lantern, but he doesn't move right away. Instead, he stares at me, the bottom halves of our faces monstrously lit by the lantern, and his somehow just as beautiful as ever. Then he takes the back of my neck in his free hand and kisses me, deeply, slowly, hungrily, and it's been too long since his mouth was last against mine, but even then, it wasn't like this. It was feverish and desperate, like we were both trying to get as far as we could before reality set in and we had to stop. Now, it's thorough. A deep stroke of his tongue into my mouth, a purposeful slide of it over mine. Not an accidental release of pent-up lust, but an intentional exploration of each other's topography, of what feels good, of the sound he makes when I bite his lip, and the way my spine curves inward when he traces mine with the tip of his tongue. My bones seem to melt, every muscle softening into him, his hair slick between my fingertips, and the chill of his skin waking up every nerve from my collarbone to my thighs. And then it's over. With one last sweet brush of his lips on mine and a quick tightening of his hand before he releases it and walks into the bathroom. I stand there, not only thrumming, but also trying and failing to wipe the ridiculous smile from my face. 24. Just when I think I might be able to get the toothy grin under control, the bathroom door swings back open and Hayden steps out in my clothes. I dissolve into giggles, and his white smile flashes in the dark as he stalks toward me.
"I'm glad this amuses you," he says.
The shirt fits him all right, but the pants are capri length and tight. He looks completely absurd, and also incredibly sexy. "Who knew you were hiding all of that behind those fancy full-length pants of yours?" I tease as he comes closer, lantern swinging in his hand.
"Is this punishment?"
he deadpans.
"Is it my penance for not calling sooner?"
"Don't think of it as your punishment," I say. "Think of it as my reward." Another flicker of smile, or something very like it. I reach for him, and he lets me pull him toward me, wring my arms around his waist, and look up into his face. He brushes my wet bangs from my eyes, tucking my hair behind my ear.
"Why didn't you answer?"
"My phone died," I say. "I would have, I promise." He lowers the lantern onto the coffee table beside us and cups my face in his hands, kissing me again, once.
"I'm so sorry."
"Hayden, no," I say, but before I can go on, he tugs me toward the couch.
"I want to tell you something,"
he says. "Okay. Is this where he confesses something terrible, that he actually does have a girlfriend, or that somehow this has all been to sabotage me?" My usually overactive imagination refuses to bite. I really do trust him. Still, that doesn't totally eliminate the worry growing in my belly at his heady silence. He runs a hand over his mouth as he considers his word choice.
"No one knows this,"
he begins. "You don't have to tell me anything you don't want to," I insist, reaching for his hand. He knots his long fingers through mine.
"I told you that when I was a kid, I felt like I had to be perfect. But there's more to it than that."
"Like what?" I ask. He blows out a long breath and blinks hard a few times, like he's working himself up to something.
"It wasn't just me. My mom, she had pretty severe depression and anxiety when we were younger. I guess my dad knew, but no one else really did. And when I was in high school..."
He trails off, coughs.
"It got really bad, really suddenly. Or, I don't know, maybe she just suddenly stopped hiding it from us. She almost overdosed, and she had to go get inpatient treatment for a while. My dad was in the middle of a campaign, and she asked us to lie about it. Pretend she went to help her parents for a couple of months."
"What?" I crawl across the small gap on the couch, lifting his other hand into mine, his fingers still chilled from the cold rain. "Hayden, I'm so sorry."
"I understood why she didn't want strangers knowing," he says. "If it had gotten out, it honestly would have been big news in my hometown, and it wouldn't have been treated sensitively. But the thing that bothered me was that, until then, I had no idea what she was dealing with. She always acted fine."
I lift his hands to my lips, breathing warmth into them. "That's not your fault," I tell him. "You can't tell what's going on with a person just by looking at them."
"I know,"
he says.
"But I always felt like, if she weren't trying to be so perfect all the time, if she didn't need to look so happy, Maybe we would have known before it got that bad. Pretending everything's fine only works for so long. And I don't know. It freaks me out a little that I could feel like this about someone who's good at pretending to be fine. That I could miss it if you're actually not. It was about me, like you said.
His words crack something open in me. I climb into his lap, winding my arms around his neck. I'm sorry, I say. That all makes sense. His arms curl around my back, holding me to him.
I was rude,
he says.
I'm sorry.
I touch his jaw, angle his face toward mine. One of us is going to have to stop this, or we'll be apologizing all night. He kisses me again, this time a little faster, rougher. He pulls back to rest his forehead against mine.
I'm sorry,
he whispers, teasing, and I laugh into him, kiss him again, soft and tender this time. His hand rises to cradle the back of my head. Both of mine skate up his jaw. I pitch my weight forward into my knees on either side of his hips and shift myself into him, letting the kiss deepen. He reaches for the bottom of my sweatshirt, and I draw back to let him lift it up my torso and over my head. He drops it on the floor, whispering something under his breath when he realizes I wasn't wearing anything under it. He lets his large hands skim up from the base of my bare stomach to my chest, and I hold my breath, anticipating the moment his palms will cup me, scared they won't. My head tips back on a sigh at the light contact when they finally do, chills erupting from the waistband of my pants up to the crown of my head. He leans in slowly, kisses one side of my collarbone, then the other. Yours too, I whisper scratchily, and his eyes tilt up to mine in the dark. I reach for the hem of the shirt I loaned him, and he straightens, letting me slowly slide it up him, the heels of my hands tracing his warm skin as they go. My thighs go hot and liquid at the texture of his skin. He lifts his arms and lets me push the shirt over his head, leaving his chest bare in the mix of soft candlelight and the lantern's harsh glow. I wish I could see you better, I whisper, letting my hands rove down him now that the shirt's out of the way.
Me too.
His voice is low and hoarse. Gingerly, he pulls me back to him, our bodies melding together. The low sound that moves through him makes my blood vessels start singing. The pressure between my thighs builds into an ache. I roll myself against him, and he returns the favor, a white-hot streak of pleasure searing through me at the firm feeling of his chest pushing into mine. His hands climb down beneath my ass, angling me where he wants me. I roll my hips against him again, the friction pulling a small, breathy sound from me. He wraps me around him as he kisses the side of my neck, lets his mouth move lower. What about your rules? I say hazily. Aren't we breaking them?
Bending,
he says roughly.
Not breaking.
He takes my nipple into his mouth and I almost start crying. I slide my hand into his way too tight sweatpants, and to my incredible relief, he lets me.
God, Alice.
He groans against my chest, his teeth scraping over me again.
It's not enough.
I move myself against him harder, but he's right. It's not nearly enough. I want to taste him. I tell him as much and wind up on my back on the couch, him crawling down me, yanking my sweatpants down my hips as I buck up from the couch. His hands squeeze my bare thighs, and I writhe toward him as he presses his parted lips to the inside of one leg. He licks me once through my underwear, then sits back to pull my pants the rest of the way off, settling himself between my thighs. For a few seconds, we're mindless with hunger, my thighs wrapped around his hips, our mouths colliding, his hands clutching every bare part of me, and mine scratching down the wide expanse of his back.
These pants are about to rip.
He half laughs into my mouth. Then take them off, I suggest. Instead, he kisses his way down my body, lets his mouth chart a slow, purposeful path along the edge of my underwear before finally dipping his tongue under the fabric. I press up into him, and he slides the waistband down, bringing his mouth back to me as soon as he can. My hands twist into his hair, my lungs struggling over each breath as the flat of his tongue presses against me, and colors blaze against the backs of my eyelids at the slow, sure movement of his mouth. His grip on my thighs is firm but gentle, careful, like I'm not only delicate but valuable, and it feels as if something inside me is overflowing. I want to say his name, to tell him how good this feels, how good he is, how much I missed him in the last 2 days, and how easy it would be to love him if he'd let me. But I can barely breathe as the pleasure mounts, and with it so much affection for him that it couldn't possibly fit in my body. And then it all peaks, breaks, and I cry out raggedly, waves of sensation rolling over and through me, dragging me under like a riptide I would gladly give myself over to. He crawls up me as the final shock waves are settling, kisses me deep, our hands wound into each other's hair, our skin slick with sweat between us, his heart hammering a million miles per minute against my ribs. "I want you," I whisper into his ear, wrapping my thighs around him as he shivers against me. He slides off me, onto his side, his arms pulling me tight to him.
"If you still feel that way in a week and a half," he says, his voice rough, splintering from restraint.
"I will," I insist, touching his sweat-dampened face. I can barely see his features in the dark, just a splash of light in the corner of one eye.
"You don't know that,"
he says, tenderly running his fingertips over one side of my jaw. "What do you think is going to happen?" I ask. Under his breath, nearly a whisper, he says,
"I think if I get this job, you're going to break my fucking heart."
Tears sting my eyes, and my breath catches. "No," I say softly, trying to pull him back to me, kissing his left cheek, then his right, then his forehead. "Hayden, no."
"You can't. No,"
he says softly, almost pleading.
"This is a bad position to be in, Alice."
"I don't know," I tease quietly. "It was working out all right for me." His face remains serious.
"I know you think you'll be fine no matter what happens,"
he grates out.
"But I need you to be sure. I don't want to do this and have you hate me in 2 weeks.
"I won't," I whisper, kissing the corner of his mouth again. He lets out a slow exhale, his eyes closing and hand cupping the back of my head, relaxing a little but not completely. I can tell he doesn't believe me. He clears the gravel from his throat.
"Maybe I should just drop out."
I snap up onto my elbow. "Absolutely not," I say. "I'd never forgive you if you did that." He blinks up at me, runs a hand up over the back of my arm.
"Okay, okay,"
he says quietly.
"Then what do we do? Because we have less than 2 weeks until one of us goes home, and there's no winning for me here. If I get the job, you're not going to want anything to do with me."
"That's not true," I cut in.
"And if I don't, then I'm going back to New York, and you're here, and it doesn't matter anyway. So what are we doing here?"
"I don't know," I admit. He laugh groans, slings one hand over his eyes. I pry it away from them, kiss the center of his palm, and he nestles closer.
"I don't understand what's happening."
"We'll figure it out," I tell him.
"No, I mean,"
he huffs.
"I mean, we barely know each other, and I feel I don't know."
"Tell me." I take his face between my hands. He sets his over them.
"All I ever want is to be around you,"
he says raspingly.
"It's not just sex. I mean, I do want to have sex with you."
My limbs warm at the suggestion, but he continues.
"But that's only a part of it. This is different. It's..."
He looks at me. Hopeful or maybe expectant, like he thinks I might have the words that are evading him. I don't. I'm so overcome that the closest I can get is a threadbare, "I know." He smooths my hair away from my eyes again, kisses my temple so gently I could cry, and then his stomach gurgles, volcanically loud, and I descend into laughter. "Hungry?"
"A little,"
he admits.
"I was in a hurry to get here before the storm got worse."
"Come on," I sit up, grabbing my sweatshirt at the sudden rush of cold air that hits me from all sides. I'll make you a snack. 25. Hayden and I sit in a nest of blankets on the living room floor, eating our peanut butter and banana sandwiches, the candles glowing in a line on the mantle and TV stand.
I haven't had one of these since I was a kid, he tells me between bites.
I'm not sure I've ever had one, I confess. I just happened to grab the ingredients in my last-minute grocery run.
Do you think that eating these is a betrayal of Margaret?
He asks, and I try to subdue my surprise that he's mentioned her. Why would it be? I ask.
Peanut butter banana,
he says.
That was Elvis's thing, right? Not Cosmos.
True, I allow. But I don't think Cosmo Sinclair had a famous sandwich of choice. And aside from that, I doubt they were ever enemies. I think the media just loved to speculate about that. My eyes cut back to him. Unless she's told you otherwise. He gives me a sly, slightly disapproving look. Oh, come on, I say, lightly shoving his shoulder. You're the one who brought her up. He sets his sandwich down on the plate beside his knee, keeping his eyes on it as he chews.
So now that we've been here longer, does anything about this job seem weird to you?
How so? I ask. He drinks some water before meeting my eyes.
I don't know how to explain it.
I remember what she said, that he was basically an animated suit of armor, and debate telling him, but that seems like crossing a line, different than talking generally about our time together. I think it's a little strange that she's making us audition like this, but she's not very trusting, and I can understand why.
It's not that, exactly,
he says, shaking his head, lips parting like the words are right there and he hopes they might spill out.
I guess I feel like she's testing me, and I'm not sure how or why. And maybe it really is just about choosing which one of us she'd rather work with, but I don't know.
Well, in a week and a half, maybe we'll know, I say.
Maybe.
He agrees, clearly unconvinced.
I meant what I said. I don't have to do this. I can find a different book.
I push my own plate aside and scoot forward against him, his arms wrapping tight around me. I meant what I said, too, I say. We're in this situation because of her. Let's let her choose how it ends.
If you change your mind.
He says. I rest my head on his shoulder. I won't. He holds me a little more tightly, burrows his mouth against the crown of my head. I stir awake on the couch to the sound of birds, but the room is mostly dark. It takes me a minute to remember why. The storm, the plywood window coverings. Hayden. There's a soft clink in the kitchen, and I blink away the sleep in my eyes to see Hayden putting a mug in the dishwasher. On the table beside the couch, the lamp has turned on at some point, the electricity evidently restored. Hayden catches me watching him.
Hey,
he whispers. It feels like my heart is splitting open in a smile. Hey. Despite his size, his footsteps are nearly silent as he crosses back toward me. Leaving? I murmur.
Storm's over, so my interview's back on.
He crouches in front of me, his hand palming the entire right side of my head like the basketball player he never was.
Go back to sleep.
He leans forward and kisses me once on the lips, my eyes drooping shut, like if I can't see him leave, maybe it won't happen. I listen as he approaches the front door, then give in, slitting one eye open as he turns back, his hand on the knob.
See you tonight?
He asks. I'll have to check my schedule, I joke. Don't want to forget anyone's half birthday party.
No, never,
he agrees. Tonight, I say. He opens the door, and another beautiful day of Georgia sunshine pours in around him. He looks like an angel. I mumble something along those lines, and then close my eyes and let sleep pull me down into itself. When I next wake up with a crick in my neck and sweat coating my skin, light is spearing into the room. I sit up, bleary-eyed, and nearly scream when someone appears in the window directly across from me. It's just the bearded maintenance guy from the rental company, prying the plywood off the windows. He gives me a cheery wave, and when I return it, he flashes me a thumbs up. For some reason, I return that too. Then he goes back to his work, his whistle mostly muted by the glass between us. I gather the blankets off the couch and carry them back into the bedroom, my stomach flipping at the smell of almond caught in the sheets. Last night, we'd drifted off together on the couch, and twice we'd woken up already moving together in our sleep, then kissed and touched each other until we were shaking with need, only to eventually, against all odds, fall asleep again. Or I did anyway. Hopefully Hayden did, or his full day of interviewing will be grueling. I toss the blankets back onto the bed and grab a change of clothes before heading into the bathroom for a shower. Afterward, hair combed and sunscreen on, I make a cup of coffee and take it out front. The maintenance guy has left, and out on the driveway, two trash barrels are stuffed with fallen branches and debris from the storm, including one of the bungalow's shutters, which looks like it ripped off and broke in half at some point in the chaos. Otherwise, you'd never know there was a storm at all. When I go back inside, I remember to plug in my phone, which is now thoroughly dead. The second it turns on, I'm barraged with all the calls and messages I missed last night. There are the ones I knew to expect, Margaret and Hayden each trying to get a hold of me, Hayden in an increasingly panicked fashion. The ones I could have guessed I'd get, my friend's group chat devolving into an argument about a true crime docuseries that Priya, Bianca, and Killian all had vastly different opinions on. And then there are the messages that surprise me. Theo, at some point yesterday, wrote to say, "I'm really sad our visit didn't pan out. Miss chilling with you." And when I didn't leap to reply to that, he followed up with, "Might actually be heading back to Atlanta soon. You still in that area?" I leave that one alone. Regardless of what does or doesn't happen with Hayden, I'm finally done making Theo's plans for him. And then the last and most worrying surprise. 4 voicemails from Mom. 3 messages. "Call me. Why aren't you answering your phone? Please call me, Alice." The panic is immediate. The heat, then cold, that flushes through me is intense. I'm instantly sweating, afraid I'm going to be sick, despite the fact that my throat feels impossibly tight. My first thought, like so many times before this, is a deep, desperate, "Audrey." I dial Mom and it rings out, all the way to her voicemail. I hang up and try again, wishing I could pace, but tethered in place beside the electrical outlet, all the restless energy inside me trapped. The line clicks halfway through the third ring. "Oh, thank God," she says. "What happened?" I get out between chattering teeth. "Is she okay?" "What? Who?" Mom says. "Audrey," I blurt. "Why wouldn't your sister be okay?" Mom sounds very nearly offended by the idea. That alone is enough to interrupt the anxiety circuiting through my body. I slump onto the arm of the couch, my shoulders slackening and a headache starting up, as if the sudden burst and then abrupt dissipation of cortisol has put me in a state of withdrawal. "Why wouldn't your sister be okay?" What a strange question to ask after all those years when her very existence wasn't a sure thing, let alone her okayness. I shut my eyes tight and massage the bridge of my nose. "What did you need?" I ask. "Why weren't you answering your phone?" Mom asks with her signature bluntness, entirely avoiding my question. "I let it die by accident," I say, "and then the power went out." There's a silence on the other end. "Hello?" I prompt. "So you're still in Georgia," she says. "Yeah, for now," I say, noncommittal. "What did you need, Mom?" "Nothing, nothing." She sounds distracted, if not disinterested. My gut twists. "You sent me a few texts and left some messages. I thought there was an emergency." "Well, good thing there wasn't," she says lightly, "seeing as how I had no way to get a hold of you." I grimace, move my fingers up to the spot right between my brows, and draw little circles there, trying to ease the tension. "Sorry, but I'm here now. What's up?" "Nothing," she says. "I just saw we had a big storm coming in and realized I didn't even know where you are." There's a serrated edge to her voice, almost like she's mad at me. But it's not like I was keeping my location from her. I told her I was on a work trip a couple of hours away from her, and she didn't ask for any more information. I'm up on Little Crescent, I tell her now. There's another long pause before she says,
You guys get hit pretty bad up there?
Not too bad, no, I say. Lost some branches, but the power's already back on, and the house I'm staying in didn't take too much damage.
Good, good, she says, distracted again.
What about you? I ask. Any issues?
Oh, no, nothing major, she says. You know how it is. We're far enough in from the coast to miss the worst of it. Heard there was some flash flooding, but we were fine.
That we lodges itself into my heart like a tiny arrow. I'm not sure if the we in question is her and my dad, or if it's her and the chickens, and I'm not sure which of those possibilities would break my heart less. I clear my throat.
Good. And your friend, Hayden? He's all right?
He's good, I assure her. I saw him this morning. He's fine. The truth, just not the whole truth.
Well, good, she says, like we've settled something. Then I'll let you go.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, I say, uncertain what exactly just happened. This is how it is sometimes between the two of us, like we each speak a different language and so have to do our best muddling through rough translations in a third language, one that's native to neither of us.
Yeah,
she says, then adds, a little more softly, but still almost chiding,
Charge your phone, kid.
I will, I promise. She hangs up without a goodbye. At our next session, we board the boat prepared. For one thing, I'm wearing a pair of loose linen pants and a light button-up, so my limbs are covered. For another, before we came down to the dock, Margaret doused our hands and feet in some kind of homemade concoction that Jody swears by. She's still on vacation? I ask as we're climbing into the boat, and Margaret blinks at me for a moment before averting her gaze and settling herself on the seat beside the fan.
Yep, she says. You know how it is. Sometimes you just need a break.
I try to give her a reassuring smile, but she's not looking at me, already focused on starting up the fan. I take my position on the seat nearest to her, and we motor away from the dock into the reeds, the thick air billowing over my hair and skin like thousands of tiny fingers. We can't really talk until we get to the spot she's keen to show me, not over the roar of the fan, and in the interim, I find my mind wandering back to Hayden. After he finished with Margaret yesterday, we went to dinner at Rum Room, sat on opposite sides of his favorite booth, picking away at our work while eating veggie dogs and fries, our legs tangled together beneath the table. Every time I got up to use the bathroom and had to walk past his side of the booth, he snapped his laptop shut, as if the temptation of seeing his screen might be too much for me to bear. I started making a game of it, getting up and walking past him every few minutes. Finally, after 4 trips to the bathroom in 20 minutes, he left his laptop open. And in my surprise, my eyes actually did go straight to the screen. In ludicrously large font on an otherwise blank page of a Microsoft Word document, he'd written, "Having fun?" At my snort of laughter, he turned sideways on the bench and hauled me down into his lap, a public display of affection that surprised and delighted me. Made me feel like he was claiming me as his, like he was openly mine. After that very long working dinner, he drove me home, walked me to the door, and kissed me slowly, roughly against it until we were both out of breath. He didn't stay over, and I understood why. He looked so tired a light breeze could probably have knocked him over, and it had occurred to me, way too belatedly, that the 5-ish inches of height he had on me had probably made our night together smooshed on the couch all the more brutal for him. Plus, there was my snoring. I doubted that spending the night in my bed would have been any more restful. So we said goodnight, and then he texted me from his hotel room, "Can't stop thinking about you." And I lay awake a solid hour anyway, regretting not dragging him inside when I had the chance. The boat's fan cuts, and Margaret tosses a speculative gaze my way.
What's got you smiling like that?
You know me, I say. I'm always smiling.
Not like that, she says, digging a net out of the bottom of the boat and passing it to me. That's a secret smile.
She waves an arm toward the shore.
See that little outcropping there?
We've stopped at a bend in the creek, and a sandy gap in the dense curtains of live oak along the shore reveals the charred remains of a campfire and a couple of wooden crates I'd guess someone's been using as makeshift chairs.
Yeah?
Margaret pulls another net out of the bottom of the boat and swings this one over into the water.
That is where the teenagers come to drink.
And? I must be making some kind of face, because she rolls her eyes.